Welcome to Career Tours. This week, succession plans for individual contributors. The questions this cast answers are, why do I need a succession plan? Where do I look for a successor? And do I need to know my successor? If you read the papers, if you read the Wall Street Journal, which we recommend you do, one of the things you'll see when CEOs or C-suite executives leave big companies is that there is already someone ready to take their place when they leave, that person being a successor. And the company will have put together a succession plan. That is, they've been looking for the person who will replace the CEO or whoever it is for a long time, probably years. It's a long process. But it's really rare that anyone suggests that individual contributors or first-line managers have succession plans. But if they did, life would be much better. It would be better for you as the person moving on. It would be better for your team as the people that are staying. So in this cast, we're going to talk about how to write or how to create a succession plan for yourself and the actions that you need to take around that.
Absolutely. We're going to talk about how to develop a succession plan, create a profile, identify potential successors, and include a training plan.
So a succession plan is a plan that companies and managers make to deal with the fact that they know that eventually every employee will move on, whether they move on because they got a new job, or they move to a different part of the country, or they retire, or they're in an accident, the proverbial bus hits them, whatever. Everybody will eventually move on, and eventually they will need to fill that position. And the reason that people leaving often causes a lot of drama is because the team doesn't have a succession plan. They don't have a plan for someone being hit by a bus. We really should stop saying that. They don't have a plan for that role not being filled suddenly. And so the plan for filling that position, if somebody gives 2 weeks' notice, the plan for who's going to do that work in 2 weeks' time is often made up on the spot. It's like, okay, what are we going to do? Okay, you do this and you do that and I'll do the other and we'll stop doing that. And that's why the plan often fails. And 2 weeks after somebody left, there's chaos. And so the succession plan is the embodiment of an organization's thoughts about business continuity. It's a plan for continuity and a prevention of the drama of, oh my gosh, so-and-so is leaving in 2 weeks. We don't even know what he does, let alone who's going to do that work.
Absolutely. The only reason that succession plans aren't often seen for individual contributors, which means a person who has no directs, right, is because succession plans are almost always organizational efforts. So it exists at a level that the organization is kind of thinking about it, right? And so this often means that HR takes the lead. And because there are not enough HR people to create plans for every single role that exists in the organization, they focus on the places where they can get probably the most bang for their buck, right? And so they only create succession plans for the most high-value performers. And that often means the people who would cause a lot of risk for the business if they left. And that exists sometimes at a higher level than the individual contributor lever.
Yeah, the difference between a first-level manager leaving and the CEO leaving suddenly is a huge amount of risk for the organization. So any sensible HR person would have a plan for the CEO leaving, and then they'd work down the organization, down through the organization chart, but often they don't get as far as third line managers, let alone first line managers or individual contributors.
Right. Your company doesn't make the front page of the Wall Street Journal if three individual contributors leave or three frontline managers leave. It makes the front page of the Wall Street Journal when your CEO resigns or your CEO gets swapped out, I guess.
Yeah. And in an ideal world, HR would have a succession plan for every role, but they're not going to. It's not realistic to think that they will have. And so you can do it for your own role. And this is pretty self-serving in some respects, because if you're the kind of person that's listening to this podcast, you're probably the person who cares about your team and your work and your clients and what will happen after you leave. And you want to know that things are going to go well. And one of the ways that you can make sure they go well is having a succession plan. It's good for you and it's good for your team. So why not do it?
Of course, it is a little self-serving. And if that self part of ourself is associated with our role, that's a good thing.
Yeah. So the plan consists of three parts: working out what kind of person with what skills will best succeed you, looking for the candidates, looking for people who have those skills, and helping those candidates get ready.
We do a lot of our effective hiring manager kind of content at our private client events when we go into a certain organization and do some training. And I just got off the phone with one of our clients who was talking about the candidates they're bringing in and they're really their focus on that. And that real drive to bring the right people in is something that an organization needs to focus on for continuity. And I think if you're an individual contributor and you're listening to this cast, if you're making a plan like this, it's going to set you apart, right? It means that like you're thinking about the business as opposed to your individual role. And it's also kind of one of those things I would think of as a person who is coming in, even a person who is being hired. I would want to know their take on their role in the organization.
That's right. Yeah.
Even if they're getting individual contributor stuff. So we see this a lot with our client work that we do. And, you know, we go into organizations and do that work. And it's kind of a parallel here, just that if you're thinking about who to hire, remember that you're also thinking about what makes someone in your role successful. And this is kind of a byproduct of that. It's like two birds with one stone.
It is. And if you want to us to come visit you, just email us at customerservice@manager-tools.com.
We'd love to come visit you.
Yeah, wherever you are.
Yeah, we'll go anywhere. I'm going to Canada in a couple of weeks. So we go there, we go all over. Sarah's in Belgium. It's great.
Belgium's better than Canada because of chocolate.
Oh, Sarah's going to be so sad that you said that.
That's just my opinion. Okay, so let's keep going. So the next thing we need to do is create a profile. So you can't create a succession plan, or you can, but it won't be any good, without thinking about who is the person who is going to replace you, what skills and traits and experience that person will need. You can't find that person unless you know what they look like in terms of what their resume looks like, in terms of experience and so on.
They need to have purple hair.
So a list of skills and experience might look like a high school diploma or equivalent, a business degree preferred, 6 months prior sales, retail, telecom, marketing experience, excellent communication, presentation, interpersonal and problem-solving skills, integrity and commitment to customer satisfaction, the ability to multitask in a fast-paced team environment, and the ability to maintain customer confidentiality. And if you think that sounds like a job description, that's because it is.
Right. Again, two birds with one stone, right? We're talking about the list of skills and the experience that someone doing your job would need. And of course, you're the person best suited to define that. It's the profile of someone who would fill the role. And that's not just about you. It's also, it's a job description because they're very similar. I guess the best way to say it is the description of the role doesn't always make it a job description, but a job description would probably always be a description of the role.
Yes, that's exactly right.
Yeah. And so we want to consider all of those things. In order to really be comprehensive, we want to think about the criteria, which is educational and experience pieces, right? That's the two pieces. Like, what kind of education situation are you looking at? And then what kind of experience situation are you looking for? We also want to consider skills and abilities. Those are the things that someone is able to do, right? Like, they can create a P&L or they can write code without bugs or something like that. Then also traits and characteristics. And traits and characteristics are the things that someone is, right? They're qualities in a person, like someone's detail-oriented or they're persuasive. we often see traits and characteristics through behaviors. And so there's a little bit there. Because sometimes people ask us, what do you mean by skills and abilities and traits and characteristics? And
yeah. How are those different?
Exactly. And what we mean, of course, is that we're looking for what someone's able to do and also what that person is. Like, are they creative? Are they detail-oriented? All those things. So those are the kind of key components in order to make your profile of this person comprehensive. And once you know what you're looking for, you can start to look out for people who fit the bill. Because, of course, we want to consider not only what would make them successful, but who might be able to be successful.
And we didn't say this, but we probably want to start this a year before we decide that we want to leave. You can just find people. I mean, you can give your 2 weeks' notice. The company can put ads out or contact a recruiter. They can send resumes and we can go through the normal process. But if you're writing a succession plan, then really you should be doing it a year before you are preparing to leave so that you can work through this. Who do we need? Finding that person and hopefully being able to get them in before you leave so that there's some kind of handover. I'll say the list again so that you can write it down. But if you don't want to write things down, if you buy a personal license, you can get the show notes and you get everything that we're saying. You don't have to take notes at all. So criteria are education and experience. Skills and abilities are the things that people are able to do. And traits and characteristics are the things that someone is.
Now that we know who we're looking for, we're going to identify potential successors. And the best case scenario will be that you have multiple potential successors, that you can think of a few people who might be able to fill your role. You're probably most likely to find those people are internal at your company. It might be someone more junior to you on the team or someone in another team who you know wants to do the work that you do. It might be someone you met on a project or at a training or even at a social event at your organization. We want you to think broadly, right? We talk about this when we talk about you want to have a big bench, which is like a big group of people that you can consider. And so we want, don't think too narrowly about the people that you might consider. Think internally, and then also you might consider externally. It is possible to find your potential successor externally. It could be someone you interviewed recently or so outside the company, which you interact with a lot at work, maybe a customer or a contractor. It could even be someone you work with at social events like your church or Little League or community stuff. Even if you don't want to leave your job for a year or two, again, you should start looking now. It takes a lot of time to identify things like this, and much more time than you think. Humans are terrible at predicting how much time things take. And so this is going to take more time than you think. You want to start with some advance time coming up. But, I mean, 6 months might be the smallest amount of time you could do this, but that's probably a crunch time frame. And again, we're looking for people. And once you have your list, you want to create a document that lists their pluses and minuses. So take a look at the profile you created and compare them to it. Say, how can I compare this person against the standard of the job? And it doesn't really need to be formal. It can be a note on your phone or a page in your notebook. You might make some kind of like document for yourself, I guess. Like, I've done stuff like this in Word, but it really doesn't matter the format. The point is to make the list, right? You do want to make the list. And every so often, you want to look at the list and think about what growth that person has shown, if they've gotten better at a certain thing that might help. Some people will overcome their weaknesses and others will grow in their strengths. You need the list to know what you thought a few months ago and see how the person's progressing against the skills and characteristics, the traits and abilities, and their experience.
Our memories are fallible when it comes to this stuff. It's like, what did you do last week? Can't remember. What did you think of this person 2 months ago with regard to this specific skill? Not a clue. So you need to write it down or put it in a computer or whatever. You need to have access to it so that you can look at it. And, you know, you're making a judgment about those people. Now, those people won't necessarily be the person who fills your role, but it's a start. It's an idea. maybe you start with someone and you think, oh, Rosie's going to be great. And then 3 months later, she moves to the other side of the world. Now she's off your list. But you do know that someone like Rosie would be great. So you think about, okay, what kinds of experience and skills and traits and all of those things that Rosie had. Then you start looking for someone else who is similar or has similar experience. And when you do find that person, do what you can to encourage them. So you could meet them for lunch or coffee and find out what they want to do in the future. Because it's possible that you find someone who you think is going to be great and they don't want to do your job. Do their ambitions align with the role that you're leaving? And remember, the other thing is that as you go through this process, your role is changing because nobody's role stays the same. Conditions in the company change, conditions in the environment change, things change all the time. So somebody who was suitable 3 months ago may not be as suitable when now you have got to where you are and you're looking 3 months in the future. So if we go back to that person, do their ambitions align with the role that you'll be leaving? Do they need advice on skills to foster? Now, if there is somebody that you know and you kind of halfway say, hey, did you ever think about doing QA? And they say, yeah, do you know what? I'd love to do QA one day in the future. But, you know, right now I'm programming, but I watch our QA guys and I think they're really important to the customer and that really appeals to me. Then you can say you're the person who's the expert. Well, you know, out of what I know about you, the one thing you really need to learn is X. You're not promising them that they're going to have your job, which is why it's important for you to say something like, did you ever consider doing my role? Because you want to know that's part of their career plan. And then you're encouraging them in their own career plan. You're not encouraging them by thinking you're going to give them your job, which is not yours to gift. Sometimes you need to see someone demonstrate certain skills to make sure they're the one. Maybe you need to see someone present. And you have that in the back of your mind and then you find out that they're going to some industry thing or they're presenting a soft skills course at the church or, you know, somewhere where they have to stand up in front of people and talk. And you think, oh, I can go along to that and see whether or not they have the skills that I think they have. There's no guarantee that this person will be successful in an interview. So unless you own the company and therefore can make them successful in the interview, you can't promise the job. But you can be a mentor to them. And that contact that you have will allow you to judge whether or not they'll be a suitable successor. You know, when it comes to when you hand your resignation in, you can say to your boss, hey, I've been talking to Jack for the last 6 months about roles in QA. He's got these 5 skills, which I think would be really helpful. I know this is something he's interested in. So you might want to talk to him or his manager about moving over here in order to fill my spot. And your boss will go, oh, thank goodness, somebody's got a plan. Because the worst thing for managers is for you to resign. And then they go, oh my gosh, what am I supposed to do now? And that's where we come back to what we said at the beginning is there is no plan. And so there's chaos and it's all made up on the spot and then it all falls apart. If you at least have one person that you can say, I think that Davey might be good over here, you might want to talk to him. There's at least a semblance of some way forward.
If your boss or your team is already dealing with having a hole, having any kind of plan is better.
Yes. Even if it doesn't work out, it's a start.
Absolutely. You know, in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. God. Yes. So after all this, what we want to do next is make sure that we're including a training plan. Once you have the person and the profile, you can really work out what the gaps are, which means the difference between their actual experience and what they'll really need to be successful. And so you know better than anybody. And even part of this is just because even job descriptions change, right? We've said that your job is changing all the time. And even the job description that was written for your role is probably obsolete. I feel like every time a new person comes into a role, the job description is pretty, it just changes because people do different things and, you know, the market's growing. And so we really need to bridge that gap.
It's possible that the person who is replacing you won't come in until after you've left. And so you have to have some kind of plan that you can leave behind for your boss and the rest of your team to get that person up to speed. You can't think, oh, well, I identified someone, I've talked to them, they're interested in coming into our team, and so I'm going to have a month training them before I leave. It might happen if you're lucky, but you can't rely on that. So it's important to have a training plan that's based on the minimum amount of knowledge that you think someone would have coming into your role. And you can go back to your definition and your description that you created and think, okay, what's the minimum my boss would allow? If your description says they have to have a bachelor's degree, do you think your boss would allow someone in that role who only had an associate's degree? In which case, assume they have that level of experience and write your training plan accordingly. It's way easier for the people you leave behind to remove things, to cross things out because they're not needed, than it is for them to add stuff that they don't know about because they don't do your job.
Absolutely. So you should really assume that this person has a baseline of knowledge, but it's not specifically the person that you were thinking of, because again, it's easier for them to get rid of pieces than add them. If you're thinking, okay, well, we don't need to write up the training on the way the ticketing system works because you're assuming that the new person will be from your company, then you're probably doing the person who has to train them a disservice, just in case, because the person who's, you know, helping the new person might not know about the ticketing service or that they need to use it. And, you know, your assumption there could be leaving a hole then. So we want to be as comprehensive as possible. And we actually, of course, have a cast about this. If you listen to our onboarding checklist cast, you'll be able to hear that part of the checklist is creating a first week plan for your new hire. And in our draft version, the person begins job-specific training with observation on the fourth day after they start.
Monday, they meet people. Tuesday, they get their computer set up. Wednesday, they go to meetings. Thursday is the first day they sit down and someone's with them and says, okay, now we're going to give you training that's specific to the job that you're doing. But of course, our outline that we've given you, our draft onboarding checklist, doesn't say what that training is because we made it to apply to everybody.
Yeah, it's pretty generic because you could be hiring someone to be in sales, you could be hiring QA, you could be hiring an engineer. And so if you look at our checklist, it says, you know, something benign. And that's what it looks like depending on the new hire, right? And the job and the availability and stuff like that. So if you're developing this plan, you want to consider that that first training is going to start pretty early, which is great. A lot of times when people get hired, nothing happens for 2 or 3 weeks, which is so sad. Everybody I know wants to hire someone and they bring them in and it's like 2 weeks before they get to do anything.
And they always say, we want someone to hit the ground running and then we're going to make them wait 2 weeks before they do.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous.
We forgot to get them a desk or a printer or something. It's very crazy. So we're going to look at this, you know, our checklist and our training plan, and we can do an example, right? So let's assume that we're developing a new app for the company, and the job-specific training for that might sound something like, review the ticketing system and workflow, choose one task allocated to me, right? And that's based on priority and level of effort, et cetera. Decide the technical approach that we're going to take for this, open development environment, and then start coding. Now, if you were training someone, you might choose a ticket of a particular kind so the new person gets exposure to something specific. And therefore, the training plan might sound like this. It might say, review the ticketing system and workflow, choose one taxonomy task allocated to me, right? So specific kind of task, decide the technical approach, open the development environment, and start coding, right? Really similar, but just a more specific outline for them so that they know really which direction to go in. And you choose taxonomy because a taxonomy describes the structure of data. And once the person understands the structure, they can work on having the app pull different data based on that taxonomy.
When you train someone specifically for a specific job in a specific environment at a specific time, you want to order the tasks that they learn in a sensible way so that they add on to one another, teaching them more and more about the business. So for example, if we were going to have a new presenter here at Manager Tools, which we are, Mark is hiring right now, we would start them out perhaps with our ops call that we have on a Friday, that because we talk about all the different areas of the business. So it's a good introduction to all the things that are going on in Manager Tools. And then later we might have them sit with Maggie, who deals with sales and clients, and have her explain things that are client specific or sales specific. But it's easier for that person to understand what Maggie does in the context of the business if they've heard everything about the whole business first. Mm-hmm. And so when you're making this specific training plan for your role, you want to think about that and make sure that anything that's general, like pick a task, is specified, pick this kind of task, because you know that that's the order that you want someone learning in. And so on the training plan, you need details. So it's, you need the task description, the reason for the task, because remember, you may not be the person training them. You may have already left the company, and it's possible that someone else training them won't know why they need to learn that. And if they don't train them and there's a good reason for it, things will go wrong. So the task description, the reason for the task, the steps to complete the task. So we were pretty specific, down to opening the environment and start coding, and then the time and resources required. So you're helping your boss, when you've left, help the team train this person. And one of the things that people don't necessarily know if they don't do your job is, who is it that knows about that stuff that can teach this person? For instance, you might have, you might be doing IT in support of a sales territory, and you know about that sales territory, but nobody else in your team does because they all have different sales territories. And so the best person to teach the new person about that sales territory may be the sales manager for that territory. And that person isn't on your team. So you would put their name in your training plan so that when they got to that point, whoever's left would say to the new hire, okay, you need to learn about this territory. We're going to put you on the phone with Bob, who's the sales manager, or we're going to send you out in a car with him or whatever. But you need to make those connections on the training plan in case you're not there.
We have a cast about the transition folder. It's in How to Resign, that cast, How to Resign. And, you know, we put together the plan. So when you start the folder, you need to include the key project report, your overview of activities and status, spreadsheets of status, presentations with notes of status, any issues that are going on, that are happening, politics that are maybe occurring, which is very closely related, of course, to relationships and who does what and who's important and who to ask questions of, your plan for the next 90 days, and the training plan. So this is kind of in addition, right? This training plan that we've been talking about how to create. So you're going to use this transition folder to brief your boss when you leave. And it's the way that a professional would leave a job. It's the way that, you know, someone, I guess, who's above and beyond in the individual contributor level would leave the job. And it also provides the peace of mind that you haven't just left your team in a lurch.
A lot of people worry that they are indispensable and therefore can't leave. And it's very sad when you go back to a job a month after you've left and discover you weren't indispensable at all. But this is another way to feel like you leave your team in a good place. Even if you haven't found the right person or they don't hire that person, they still have a plan to train the next person. And that's the way to leave a job properly. And it seems like an awful lot of work, which is true. But one measure of success is not how well you do, but how well the guy after you does. If he fails, it may be because you didn't choose the person, or whoever hired him didn't choose the right person. It could be because they didn't train them properly, or you didn't leave the documentation that would enable him to succeed. And if he doesn't succeed and you got an internal promotion, you could well find yourself back in that job that you were trying to leave. So there's a good incentive, especially if you're moving internally, to do all this work and to leave a job properly. Thanks, Kate.
Thanks, Wendy.
all for this week. We'll be back next week with more guidance.